Hello, this is the first proper podcast I've recorded for the website, and I'm joined by Daniel Bacon.
Hello.
Hello, Daniel, yes. It's the 2nd of June 2019, and before we start chatting, I'm going to just outline a bit about what we're doing here. I'm hoping to put regular podcasts up on the website, as I think there's lots of interesting people out there and lots of interesting things to talk about, and the audio format is actually a pretty good one for this type of stuff. It is quite heavy, sort of social welfare, housing law, but for people that spend all day reading letters and documents and law reports, it might be quite nice to have something you can just listen to or watch a video on YouTube while you're possibly doing something else and just have in the background. Yeah. So that's the purpose of the podcast. And then I just say I've been blogging for about 10 or 12 years now. I must admit, I used to do it a lot more than I did. And then I had kids and I got less time on my hands. And the funny thing was that back in the 10 years ago, it seemed with the online stuff that there was about to be this sort of revolution and a critical mass would be reached where everybody would have their own online profile and be discussing things in a sort of Wikipedia environment, but it never seems to have happened. And there's really only Giles Peaker and the Nearly Legal blog is still out there regularly publishing. There was me, and there was Nathaniel at Hackney Law Centre, who produced a blog called Frontline Hackney, which was very good and still is. But like me, he only manages to publish something about once every 6 months, which is a shame. There's quite a lot of activity on Twitter, but by its nature is sort of limited and it's often rather dull. People sort of putting out corporate messages. So I'm going to try and get back to doing something interesting with social welfare law that'll be informative, not just for lawyers and those working in it, but perhaps for people who are interested in the issues which arise from it. So, Daniel, maybe we could talk about you for a minute. So you and I work together at the moment at Hann & Co in Battersea.
We do, yes.
And you are at the moment working there as a paralegal.
Yes, that's right.
But if I may say, you've already achieved in what's about a year now, isn't it? You've been there.
I've been there for about 9 months so far.
And I think you've achieved quite a high degree of knowledge of the subject matter and specialisation already, although I think it does take a long time to get confident with it. And I've been doing this for 25 years or so, and I'm still learning all the time, often sort of lessons the hard way. I'm aware that we're all sort of in it together in terms of learning. So it's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Will.
Tell me about your impressions of housing law so far in the 9 months you've been doing it. Was it as you expected it to be?
I came in not really knowing what to expect entirely, but I've been very pleased with what I've discovered in housing law in respect of it does feel like real law. And the reason I changed career to come into law is that I enjoy the process of the law, and I knew that I would enjoy it at a place like Hann & Co. So I'm pleased to be doing housing because it does give me that, whereas I think certain other departments are less law and more personal relationships, maybe, and interacting with people on a more human level, whereas possibly it's more like it's the Dalek in me. I like the...
I know what you mean. I think if you want to do law, then housing is a good area to work in, because there is often a right or wrong legal answer, whereas in the other... Yeah. In the other areas of law, you never quite know with crime. It will turn on the facts and the perception of the facts that the jury have, and perhaps the sort of theatrical skills of the barrister.
Yes, it's true.
That's true in housing as well. But you can sort of
But I think crime is an enjoyable area of law as well. I mean, from my GDL studies, the more human sort of relationship type of law that I was referring to more is we've got a really good care department at Hanenko and a really good family department. But I get the impression that those are more, you know, everybody's trying to work in the best interest of the child, and you know that's what everyone wants. So hopefully everyone's on the same page, and it's just more of how to get there rather than looking at particular legal principles or particular statutes and laying down the law in that way. But I do like that latter.
Yes, me too. So the thing that I think is surprising, and I've been surprised by it myself over recent years, and I think it's something that has only been sort of coming into consciousness, is the extent to which, although what we've just said is true, housing law is often about, not really about law in the sense of applying the law which people are either complying with or consciously breaking, but we're sort of in the role of, in terms of clients, we're often dealing with people who've had some sort of genuine difficulty complying with things, rather than, so we're sort of have to be conscious of sort of mental health issues.
Yes.
And then in terms of our opponents, it's often a case of dealing with what I would call the regulation of bureaucracy, that large organizations, whether they're local authorities or social landlords, simply get it wrong because their staff are not as trained as they might otherwise be, and they don't have the resources to deal with complex issues. So it's not like we're all sort of at times crossword puzzle levels of applying the law. We're often dealing with people that have got clients who have little or no idea of what they're supposed to be doing and have given up trying to do it if they were ever capable of doing it. And landlords who are struggling to do what they should do and often getting it wrong. But that makes it sort of fascinating as well, I think, but it takes it away from the law side of it. So having seen what you've seen for the last 9 months, I know it's probably too soon to tell, but do you see yourself possibly working in this area in 10 years' time? Would you?
Yes, no, absolutely. I can see that. Where I really enjoy the sort of legal issues that we come across in housing law, and I really enjoy the client interaction as well. So, as you say, there is that human element, which is also very rewarding when you can successfully act for a client. So I definitely would like to continue working in housing law. And I think I'm building up a good knowledge base to be able to do that.
Yeah, which allows us to see into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which was the blog you started writing just in the last 2 or 3 weeks, isn't it, that you
started
doing that?
Yeah.
So perhaps we could tell the listeners the address to find it at.
So the address is dbaconlegal.com, and I started the blog because in discussions with you, I knew that you were doing your own blog, and so I enjoyed reading that and found it very useful. And I think that where I'm currently learning, and I often come across little intricate details of the various rules that we need to abide by, I like understanding those rules fully and being able to explain them to other people if necessary as well. So I think it's useful for me to be looking into something in detail and then writing it up in a blog so that I can sort of hopefully help other people with my research as well.
Yeah, it's often the case, I think, that if you're trying to understand something, writing it down in a way that you would communicate what you understand to somebody else is a way of achieving that. And until you've written it down or sketched it out, you don't necessarily feel that it's in your head in a format that you can understand. So it's very helpful.
Yes, to write it down. Yeah, I think so.
Plus, the blog is good as you can remember things rather than just write it on some sort of notebook that doesn't get looked at. Because I remember that when, I think that was when, why Giles Peaker set up the Nearly Legal blog back when he was a trainee, was so that he could remember things that he'd learned and have them stored somewhere. And it made excellent sense to share them with everybody.
Yes.
And we've all benefited enormously from what he did and continues to do. I still don't know how he has the energy to do it, but it's great. So you've gone in really at the deep, and I've learned some very useful things from the last two posts you've done, which listeners may find as well. I'll put a link to the blog and to the blog on this blog so people can go there. But the point, there was one thing I learned that was really useful. I must admit, I don't do a lot of mortgage repossession work, but you pointed out that defending a mortgage repossession case doesn't fall within housing law, it falls within debt law for legal aid contract purposes. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. So I, in writing that blog, I did investigations into the different types of housing, the different types of legal aid contract that exist, and looking at the standard terms of the civil contract as well with the legal aid agency. And yeah, so I found some things that I wasn't really aware of, because until this point I've been really researching the rules surrounding financial eligibility for clients who come in, as well as matters that are and are not in scope for legal aid in respect of the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act. So I've been looking at those issues, looking at the detailed sort of rules as to those, and I want to write some blog posts about those issues as well, because they are very important, obviously, for determining whether or not somebody can be provided with legal aid. But there's also this additional hurdle, which actually is the contractual hurdle, the contractual relationship that exists between a firm and the legal aid agency. And it's not enough for somebody to be financially eligible, nor is it enough for a particular issue to be within scope for legal aid, but also the particular contract that a firm has with the legal aid agency needs to include that particular type of problem.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense necessarily that things which you would assume
would be within
housing arms, like the mortgage repossession.
Yes. Yes.
Why that should be debt.
More importantly, for one of our recent cases, the issue in relation to tenancies and old style tenancies. So at the moment, if somebody is a victim of domestic abuse and needs to leave the family home, then the council will grant her, usually, a new tenancy, but they'll do it under the new rules, and they may very well only be issuing tenancies that don't have the same type of security of tenure as the older style tenancies. So they might be issuing a fixed term tenancy or some sort of flexible tenancy.
Yeah.
And that means that the domestic abuse victim will be penalised essentially in terms of her security of tenure because she needs to move home. And I did discover a new law which technically came into force on the 10th of May last year. It's the Secure Tenancies Victims of Domestic Abuse Act 2018. And so that received royal assent on the 10th of...
Sorry to interrupt you, but this is the one you blogged about. You've done a separate blog post on this, haven't you?
Yes.
We can add a link to that if people want to go in more detail. Yeah, sorry, go on, please.
Yeah, sorry, I'm probably going into too much detail.
No.
So if somebody is a victim of domestic abuse and needs to leave the home because of that, they risk also not only being a victim of domestic abuse, but also losing their security of tenure when the council rehouses them with a new tenancy. Mm. And the act that I just referred to that was passed last year was supposed to, or is supposed to, place a duty on councils to provide that victim with a tenancy type which is of the same type that she is fleeing from. But it hasn't actually been put into force yet. And the reason I bring it up is because of the contractual issue that we're talking about. If that was in force, there wouldn't be any problem with a housing lawyer dealing with that lady's housing problem in respect of her security of tenure, because they could use that act to ensure the council is rehousing her in the correct way, in line with the appropriate legislation, including the Secure Tenancies Act. But currently, the only way that that housing issue can be resolved is under a family law contract in respect of the Family Law Act 1996. But I do write about that in my blog post.
And
but
it's just under really, family contract. Don't...
Yeah, it's strange.
A housing lawyer couldn't do that.
Yeah, it's strange that a house, something that's clearly relating to housing, because it's relating to how somebody is rehoused by the council in terms of her security of tenure, that doesn't fall, or at the moment, that can't be dealt with adequately under a housing law contract. And the only way it can be dealt with and her security of tenure maintained is for the old tenancy, the actual tenancy that already exists over the house that she's fleeing, for that tenancy to be transferred into her sole name in the family courts.
Yeah.
So only a family lawyer can do that. And it wouldn't resolve her security of tenure issue if she needs to actually leave the property and go to a new property and a new tenancy.
Have you come across the comparable one, which comes as a shock to many people, and they learn it the hard way when they realise they're not going to get paid, is that housing law contracts cover injunctions for antisocial behaviour. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure they do. I don't tend to do many of those, but I think that comes within a housing contract. But if the person breaches the order and there's an application to commit them to prison for it, that isn't covered by housing. That's a criminal contract.
So, I mean, these are very strange sort of...
Yeah. I mean, that's something we could perhaps talk about another day. And I'd love to discuss it. And it's great to have someone from the legal aid agency, but why the legal aid agency need to frame these rules in such a sort of harsh way. You wouldn't think that doctors would be restricted from carrying out work in terms of patients' conditions if they were one thing or the other. Oh no, you can't do that. Yeah. So I suppose there may be similar rules, but it seems unnecessarily harsh and difficult when there's not that many lawyers around, and whether you can get a family lawyer to do that for you at a particular time. I subscribe to your blog now, and I look forward to new posts. And it's inspired me to try and write something else myself, which I haven't done for a while. What I'd really like to do for the future is maybe we could try and have regular podcast sessions. I've got various other people lined up that I'd like to interview. To do with what they do in this area, but it'd be good if you could take part in some of those, because sometimes it's good to have two people interviewing somebody, so you can have a three-way discussion. It doesn't sound quite like a sort of interrogation, it's more of a chat. But also we could discuss sort of particular issues, like we've both been talking before we started recording about the Equality Act defences and recent case law on that, and that would be something maybe we could put a separate podcast together on. I think we've both got to go away and read some court cases to be more confident about what we're talking about. So maybe we could do that in a week or two.
We do have experience in our own cases that we're working on that touch on all of those issues as well.
We do. It's it's a really interesting time for, I mean, it's particularly relevant. And I think all housing lawyers, I mean, if they know about the Equality Act and its wide application, will be using it. But probably everyone's got a sense of uncertainty about quite what the parameters of it are. And I know that there's probably going to be a backlash, and there's lots of barristers and solicitors out there that work for landlords that are looking forward to sort of being able to announce that they've come up with a case that's sort of halted the tide and given some clarity to landlords so that they're not plunged into very costly litigation whenever they start possession proceedings against somebody who might have a mental health problem. But that would be something really, I would like to talk about that next time. Anything else you'd be interested in talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's probably it for now, isn't it? Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, I think that's covered.
Great. Well, look, thank you very much for helping me get the first podcast off the ground. And hopefully this is the first of many. And I will speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon. Thank you, Ryan. Bye-bye.